Hello and welcome to another news episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital currencies, and obviously also helps you to understand how digital money and assets will evolve in the future, especially now again with the focus on news over the last month. It's the 1st of June, which means we look back to the hottest news in crypto and digital assets over the last month. And joined today by me, by myself, Manuel, is also our co-host, Jonas. Hi, Jonas.
Hey, Manuel.
And our lovely co-host, Stefan from Zürke as well. Hi, Stefan.
Hi, Manuel. Good to see you again.
Again, exactly. Last episode already with you. Now another one. And what did we focus on in the last episode? On stablecoins. And that is definitely also core of our news episode today. The stablecoin media really continued in May with lots of interesting releases, lots of interesting news, which we will take a look into. And the focus is really on infrastructure adoption in different areas that we see advancing, retail use cases with crypto cards and stablecoin cards that have been issued or announced that they will be issued, where you can spend your stablecoin balance with Visa and MasterCard cards. We're going to look into stablecoin integration and merchant services through Stripe's stablecoin accounts, which was a major headline, but then also look into this X402 stablecoin protocol of Coinbase, which basically enhances the existing HTTP protocol with 402 standard that has never been finalized. So Stefan, you're going to provide an overview on that. But also we're going to look into general blockchain adoption of traditional finance players, which is continuing, especially after the US regulators have loosened their regulatory grip, as we have discussed over the last weeks and months. And it seems, yeah, public blockchain adoption continues to progress. Yeah, but without further ado, let's jump directly into the episode. And as usual, we start with a short section on the crypto market updates with a focus on ETH and Bitcoin. And Jonas, you today will provide this quick overview, right?
Yes, so generally, as always, a very dynamic month in the crypto space. So we have seen that the general crypto market grew to $3.4 trillion, which is basically now, obviously very sizable. When we look into Ethereum, maybe to start with first, it was a very, very strong month. So beginning of the month, we were the price was at $1,800. Now we are at $2,600, which is an increase of almost 50% in 1 month. So that's pretty strong. And of course, you never know, you know, which causal reasons will really drive all of that. But some reasons why we might have seen this trend is definitely the successful Pectra upgrade we also talked about in this podcast that was launched on May 7th. So basically a technical update that brings a lot of also business advantages to Ethereum, for example, around efficiency, user experience. So not just something for tech geeks, but really also for driving adoption, I think. And this is, I guess, something that the market agrees with as well.
And that was, as we discussed only yesterday, I think, Stefan, right? Very interesting upgrades and updates, which primarily still focus on layer twos. So to increase the blob space and to make layer twos even quicker, but also now introducing account abstraction features, which we already also talked in the past about, much more efficiency in user experience where gas can be spammed by others, where you can ultimately batch transactions and all this. So account abstraction features are slowly really getting included in the overall Ethereum platform. I think it's definitely worthwhile to revisit that in an extra session, extra episode, because it's a very interesting upgrade that has happened. Yeah.
Absolutely. What I found interesting regarding the price, because you always talk about the price in this news episode, is that this time after the update, the price goes up. So last time when I was thinking, okay, the merge is the biggest update of all times of Ethereum, the price actually went down all the time.
Sell the news event.
It's quite unpredictable what's happening to the ETH price.
Yes, that's actually a good point. And I would you could even say now, I mean, there was a time that momentum for ETH was pretty bad, let's say, compared to Bitcoin and others in the recent months or even the recent year. And maybe this is really some kind of a momentum switcher that now brings more positive news to Ethereum. We also do see new folks in the Ethereum Foundation, so we might see some new strategic shifts. So yeah, let's see, but definitely a very, very successful month for Ether and Ethereum. Then, of course, we also need to look at Bitcoin. Again, also a very strong month. So we started with $94,000, now at $109,000, which is an increase of around 15%. So not 50 as Ethereum, but 15. But importantly, as you can imagine from this price now, we also have seen a new all-time high on May 22nd at $112,000. So it was a month of a new all-time high. But also very interestingly, just in US dollars and not in euros. So obviously the exchange rate plays a role. So for euro, the high this month was 99,000, which is still far away, let's say, or a little bit away from the 106,000 euro all-time high, right? So this also shows how the current exchange rate dynamics also play into the Bitcoin price here as well, depending on which currency you look at. So what I really found fascinating around this new all-time high is just a few things to mention. So A is Bitcoin is now on position number 5 of the most valuable global assets and now succeeded now in front of Amazon and Alphabet. So that's strong. So remember a few months ago, we talked about that Bitcoin was in front of silver, basically, I think, kind of position 7 or 8-ish, now 5. So that's, for me, always when you zoom out, it's a little bit crazy, to be honest. And also that this price movement happened in a time where there was a very hard market environment. So US government bonds, for example, were increasing a lot when it comes to the yield. So there was even some difficulties to place a 20-year bond with US investors, which really shows and signals some, let's say turmoil or let's see some disturbances in the market. Also, tariff topics remain. So it's in steady up and down. Stocks dropped. As said, bond yield increases. So typically times of uncertainty in here, Bitcoin kind of went again, kind of against the market and the bond and the stock market and basically increased. I don't want to say this is now we are talking about the digital gold narrative because this correlation, kind of changes monthly, but at least it was very interesting that in this market phase, let's say, from a macro perspective, the Bitcoin price really reached an all-time high. Yeah, and also here, just very briefly to conclude, you can always say what's the reasons now for that. And as said before, it's very, very hard to find reasons. And I think it's even not possible to always find reasons. But what some people argued basically is that crypto regulation could play a role around that we see in the US now. We'll talk about this later on. My feeling is that this is a little bit misleading because it's primarily around stable coins and not really about crypto, but at least what some people said. I'm not sure, Manuel or Stefan, if you have an opinion about drivers or the role of regulation here. Or
We still see adoption in the US when it comes to this new asset class. We see a public administration that is really pro-crypto. I think this is going to come up later as well. Trump is still very much involved in many of the developments. And I think Bitcoin is just the OG crypto asset that people are still wanting to hold. The uncertainty rises. Then there's also the developments with Bitcoin reserves in two US states, Texas and Arizona, now apparently signed a bill to launch a strategic crypto reserve. So I don't know. Yeah, lots of developments that might support this uptick.
I think looking often from the DeFi side of things, I think we still need some news that DeFi protocols are actually allowed to issue some of their revenues towards their token holders. So we always talked about this token economy. And I think this is the one blocking factor where I think projects are still afraid that they might be considered a security, or we need to clarify how these incentives actually, or how token holders can actually participate. And I think we don't have clarity in the US for now. I thought, okay, this would be priced into DeFi tokens when Trump was elected. Actually, it didn't. Actually, most DeFi protocols went down price-wise. So actually, the environment seems to be quite good, but you still don't have the regulatory certainty what you are actually allowed to do, even in the US, even with the positive tailwinds for now. So that might be another booster for the altcoins, I guess, over time, if something positive in that regard comes out. And even if it's a strict regulation, what you're allowed to do and what not, I think that's still pending.
And your argument would be that given there is so much unclarity with altcoins, it goes into Bitcoin, and that's maybe also a driver.
Exactly. So the more experienced investors enter the stage, they will say, okay, this is all fantasy. This is where are the returns? Okay, you now see certain protocols that do interesting revenues week by week because the protocols are actually used, e.g. via rails of Coinbase and you use, for example, the pools of Morpho behind the scenes. But then if you look at the tokenomics of Morpho, even if that comes in revenue via Coinbase UI and Coinbase users, you as a Morpho token holder don't participate yet into that uptick. It's still fantasy. You still wait that at some point in time, there might be uptick for the token holders. But for now, this is in most cases not the case. And yeah, let's see how that develops.
Yeah, I can really imagine that there are also way more more clarity will be provided in the US in the near future, right? I mean, every month we talk about that more clarity now is there. I'm still think we are not fully there yet, but it's definitely improving. And what also I think besides this general better environment now contributed to the increase in price is also the ETF flows for Bitcoin. So we had again a very strong month when it comes to ETF inflows, and that's of course also is very often correlated with a price increase. So to kind of summarize that, we very positive months, all-time high for Bitcoin, and yeah, 50% increase in ETH. And yeah, this is basically where we kind of stand today as June 1st.
And lots of developments in other areas, which is not Bitcoin as a currency, but rather fiat money on currencies. Stable coins.
Yes. Which again, nice transition, really nice transition. So
was the major update. Jonas, I think you went into lead to guide us through what happened. Let's discuss the many different initiatives that came out in May. Huh?
Yeah, so I remember, Manu, where we were chatting a few days ago and we're really checking, are all these stablecoins news really from May? Because it felt like, I don't know, so many information basically that we couldn't believe that this was just 1 month, but turned out it really was. So be prepared for a lot of, I think, really crazy news, to be honest, game-changing news, maybe even. But first, let's zoom a little bit out to get the full picture on the stablecoin topic now. So the key question, of course, is what are stablecoins good for, right? So what are their use cases? And the currently most straightforward use case is really this kind of means of payment or settlement for the blockchain economy, particularly, let's say, in crypto land, right? So for example, if you trade on centralized, decentralized exchanges, if you are in DeFi, or if you want to lock in some crypto profits, you typically use a stablecoin where you can have a cost-free conversion of your crypto asset gains, a la Bitcoin or Ether, and then go into stablecoin. So I think that's without doubt currently the use case that is the one where the most volume goes in. But of course, this is limited to crypto land, to the crypto economy. So if this increases substantially, which I personally expect, of course, this will already increase itself. But a lot of the momentum of the fantasy is now also about basically, let's say, newly emerging promise use cases that are basically also very central for the current hype. And this is not just, let's say, about crypto land or the crypto economy, DeFi, but really about, let's say, interlinking this with payments, TradFi as well. And one use case here is payment and settlement. And this you can basically, you know, kind of categorize that A, it's, for example, peer-to-peer payments, similar as how we do payments today, similar to PayPal, for example, right? So that you just don't use your PayPal email address to send funds or scan a QR code in the future, but just use stablecoins, basically, because it's just an, you know, efficient payment infrastructure, for example. So that's peer-to-peer, one use case. Second one is basically corporates to business, so C2B. So basically, you can pay for goods or services with a stablecoin, for example, at, you know, a restaurant, at a supermarket, so where a terminal is present, or also in e-commerce, maybe, micropayments.
Client to business, yeah. If I want to buy something at a merchant. Yeah.
Exactly. So that's this case that we also, of course, everybody of us knows. And the third one is just B2B, right? So where basically payments between companies, be it between banks for interbank settlement, be it general treasury operations, etc. So that's kind of this newly, I wouldn't say new, because some of these activities are happening in these use cases for years. But this is now where we do see more and more traction, more news from leading players, as we will discuss in a few minutes. So my feeling is that this is where a lot of the current momentum and hype is coming from particular these use cases. And if you, again, think about, okay, this payment use cases might be nice, but what else? I think there are two other use cases for that. One is store of value, so that you can use, for example, dollar stable coins, maybe also euro stable coins in the future in areas where the local currency is very volatile. So, which is the EU doesn't want that with US dollar stablecoins, but for some smaller developing and emerging market economies, that's, I think, also a valid use cases. And of course, the topic of savings, because of course in the future you could also gain yield remuneration from stablecoins. We do now know that for Mika this is kind of not allowed, right? But that's something, you know, that maybe we see in the future, or we do see in some jurisdictions. So that's kind of the use cases that we do see around stablecoins. And again, why are we talking about this now? Because this is like old and just structured, but old. 2025 was expected to be the year of the stablecoins, and this really seems to materialize. So if you check out, for example, a study by Citi that said by 2030, there will be stablecoins in circulation between 1.6 trillion to 3.7 trillion. Today, we have 250 billion, right? So it's a factor of like 10 times if you check like the average. So that's massive. And we did see now a lot of news about major players in the space, which I think is remarkable.
Yeah, even John Bessent from the US Treasury now also recognizes this, right? And said in a public statement that also he expects 2 trillion additional demand for government bonds due to stablecoin holdings. So even the highest government official in the US Treasury is recognizing stablecoins to be, first of all, a growing asset as a new form of money, but then also to be absorbing up to $2 trillion in government debt, which is definitely significant.
And actually, I think this is the political motivation in the US to push stablecoins, actually. They want to have this demand for their treasury bills, actually, especially in geopolitical difficult times when other countries might avoid them or not buy more, but they need it. So I think that's the driving force. And maybe that's very different in other areas. So if you look into Europe, you might not have that demand and that motivation actually in that to that extent. At least if you talk to people, you get the impression that this is not the case, for example, in Switzerland. So I think this is an important part of the whole discussion. Why certain governments or regulators push stable coins or not.
And I mean, it's super smart, right? Because I mentioned in the beginning that the US currently had issue with a bond auction to get this basically sold. So if you have a new demand force, which can be stablecoin issuers, right? It's just clever, I think, to be
honest.
For me, I think it's surprising that we currently, or the EU, or like players like the ECB don't recognize this currently, but maybe let's not go into this rabbit hole because this could be easily another episode, I'm pretty sure. But what we have seen now is due to the shift in market sentiment, in politics, as you mentioned, that a lot of players announced their initiatives this year, and basically three key players, namely MasterCard, Visa and Stripe, and that's pretty big. So what they basically all said, if you are summarizing that, is stablecoins are key of their strategy now, period. So if we look into MasterCard, they launched a 360-degree approach to stablecoins, which means they wanna basically, you know, help for the whole end-to-end capability. So from the wallet of the user to the checkout in the end. So very similar how a MasterCard credit card, you know, is used today. You have the front end, you do the settlement, you have the distribution. They basically wanna do the same with stablecoins, for example. And again, I think that's super crazy news because that's like a leading player in the market that has now partnerships with a lot of exchanges, Paxos Circle issuers, do Alias Sends, etc. So it really became clear that this is core of the MasterCard strategy now.
And the news, I think, was, you know, that they also now include settlement in stablecoins, because crypto cards and also stablecoin cards have been around for quite a while, even also for MasterCard and Visa. But now they are really looking into this 360 approach in the sense that Nuvei, which is an acquirer, also wants to provide stablecoin access now to merchants so that the merchants ultimately also receive the stablecoins. And there you don't need to off-ramp ultimately into traditional money, how usually those card transactions would work, right? There was one player in the payments value chain, mostly even the issuer of the card, who ultimately received the stablecoins and then used traditional account-based fiat money to pay the merchant. And here this is now starting to change, whereas stablecoins are actually also used for the settlement.
Yeah, so the settlement of stablecoins, payment, that was one of the announcements, which I think is, again, very important. And the second one was also a lot of partnerships around wallet enablement, card issuance and acceptance, for example, with the exchange OKX and also with MoonPay, who basically acquired Iron that we also discussed in the podcast episode, some kind of an stablecoin API, if you will. So this is also part of this whole stablecoin strategy and stablecoin announcement that Mastercard made in May.
What I find interesting with that whole movement is that the professionals, so the payment processors or the card issuers, they detected stablecoins as maybe, yeah, the superior payment rails for their own processes. Imagine that. So they are faster than the public audience, maybe. So this is telling. So if they do that, if they see economies of scale there, that's big. That's the true big news behind the news, I guess.
Absolutely. And I mean, if you look, for example, Stefan, into Visa, it's very similar. So what they also basically announced is that they also want to do stablecoin settlements in their infrastructure. They also said that to date, 225 million settlement was already done with USDC. I thought this nice to get a number. I mean, of course, this is nothing compared to the total settlement volume, but still, it's 3-digit millions, right? So it's one direction. And they also have a lot of initiatives now going into enhancing cross-border movements with stablecoins, with the Visa Direct technology. They also want to enable programmability features via smart contracts, automation, so explicitly mention also this component here of smart contracts and programmability. And of course, also working on and off-ramping services, because as you said, Manuel, this is not new that you can use this also Visa cards beside MasterCard for on and off-ramp. So here they said that to date, they facilitated almost already 100 billion in purchases of cryptocurrencies, which is still a lot. But now they have new partnerships also with Bridge, we talk about later. So you see also here a lot of momentum interest. They also invested in BYNK, kind of a stablecoin payment infrastructure already in March. So stablecoins all over the place also in Visa's strategy besides MasterCard.
And from MasterCard and Visa's perspective, right? I mean, they are card companies, but ultimately settle through existing payment rails that banks provide. And here in this approach, they can basically take out the banks and move the funds in stablecoins, at least if, and that is the big if, the merchant also accepts stablecoin, right? And this is also what is so interesting with this 360-degree approach from MasterCard, but then also with the Stripe announcement, which ultimately is also a front end for managing pay-ins and payouts and acceptance for merchants to allow them to hold directly stablecoins, right? Because if you need to go in and out of stablecoins, somewhat of a stablecoin sandwich, how it's called, then obviously you have frictions because you need to have a very efficient on and off ramping infrastructure, which those companies also provide, right? So for example, Stripe acquired Bridge, as we discussed, and Bridge also provides this relatively efficient on and off ramping. However, clearly it's most convenient and most efficient if both the sender and the acquirer or the beneficiary are able and happy to hold stablecoins. And this is what we slowly also, at least from an infrastructure provision side, whether or not it's used is a different story, but at least from an infrastructure provisioning side that we see, right? Ability also for merchants to accept stablecoins, which would make it full circle without even having to go through bank rails.
And usually these on-off ramps are involving fees. So even if you have it in-house, but that's the expensive part to change the infrastructure actually for your money. So I think there's a lot of traction to keep money on-chain, park it in money market funds, etc. over time to earn something. So I think the grander scheme seems to work now. So everybody is doing the plumbing now for stable coins to get them easily sent around the world, to bring more acceptance, to create that acceptance network that we also discussed last week in our last episode. So very interesting movements. I think everything moves together into the right direction from a stablecoin perspective, I guess.
And Stripe was basically the third player I wanted to mention, because Stripe is super important, as you said, in the background when it comes to processing payments. So in 2024, they actually did 1.4 trillion payment settlement via Stripe. So this just shows that this is also a very, very clear market leader who is now, or in the previous month through the Bridge acquisition, 1.1 billion going into this direction. Very interestingly, what I was reading when I researched this here is, for example, that this can also open very new business fields for Stripe, because, for example, Bridge is active in 100 countries. Stripe is just active in 50 countries. So they also see this as part of their expansion strategy, which I also found pretty fascinating. And so that you could also roll this out. And they are now also testing this new stablecoin solution based on Bridge API this month. So this was also one news. They acquired Bridge a few months back, but now they are really testing this. Interestingly, also with companies outside the US, UK, and the EU, you want access to dollars. So it's a lot about dollarization here. So I think this was a very interesting switch. But yeah, so this is also why Stripe is very, very active here. And of course, we have also seen number four, maybe that PayPal already is in the middle of all of that, right? With their own stable coins. They even got the interest payment of the stablecoin, at least for now, somehow done. So this means all of the big players, if you will, from this PSP payment settlement space are really into that, I would say.
Yeah, one last thought, maybe also on the Stripe offering. They are now offering, only weeks after the acquisition, these stablecoin accounts fully integrated into the front end of Stripe, where you can very easily swap in and out of different forms of money. So you can issue credit cards against the Stripe balance in stablecoins, or also in a bank account. You can go from bank account into stablecoin and vice versa. So that is exactly what Bridge does. But where do they offer it? And you mentioned it already, right? It's not the areas where there are stablecoin regulations in the first place. So no EU, no Japan, no Singapore, and so forth. But rather all those countries which likely the merchants have strong demand for US dollar liquidity, right? So which have the not so stable currencies, and where they actually want to hold US dollars but cannot at the moment because they cannot hold a bank account. So that's definitely interesting, and apparently supported also by the US administration, because Josh Bassett also mentioned that they want to bring the dollar into the world and basically continue with dollarization. Whether or not the countries and the central banks and regulators in those particular countries like that, I think that will be seen. But that's definitely the market that they are addressing. So those countries which actually are eager to hold US dollars, and maybe then they are fine to hold a non-yield-bearing dollar asset, right? Similar to a bank account, which doesn't pay interest. But yeah, they're absolutely fine with that because they simply want to hold US dollars, and that is not possible with stablecoins.
Do you now think from this news that this is now basically given the ground for the, let's say, for stablecoin 10x, 100x volumes, you know? So, or put differently, is now everything in place that we need for stablecoins to thrive, or do we need more?
I think there is more that is required, to be honest, right? So for example, regulatory clarity everywhere. We have in the EU, we have MiCA. There is clarity in the US. There might be the Genius Act, where there's been interesting developments over May as well. The first try to get it done was failing, but then the second test vote actually passed. So it's quite likely that we are recording now before the end of May. So maybe even in this week, there's going to be a final vote. And then the two bills have to be merged in the House and in the Senate. So eventually we will also see something in the US. In Hong Kong, there has been a regulation passed a couple of days back. But honestly, now we have different local regulations. But if you really want to use stablecoins, especially for cross-border payments, these regulations also need to recognize each other and need to be harmonized, right? So it cannot be that they actually have clauses and parts of the bills that contradict each other, right? So that is also still, I think, an open point to name a few, or to start, let's say, with what I believe is still needed.
But I wouldn't, let's put it like that. Up to now, the success of stablecoins was not dependent on the regulatory clarity, because they were successful somewhere else. Let's put it like that. So I think we haven't seen the success of stablecoins in the right regulatory regime for now. So imagine someone sets up that regime, that everybody is motivated, then we might see a completely different picture. I think we are not there yet. They evolved somewhere where someone didn't care, or where it was easy to evade the old regulations. So all that we've, most of what we've seen for now is just preludo before the big show begins. That's at least in my eyes. So imagine we have a motivating regulation in the US. We have a motivating regulation in the EU, which Mika, I think, is not yet there. Then the picture might be dramatically different from my personal point of view.
Yeah.
And I think for those use cases that we just talked about, really this regulation is required, right? Because we are now entering a completely new area where you go from crypto out into the real world and into real commerce, where business also eventually use it. So, yeah.
Absolutely. B2B is the big point here. So if we enable that, then let's go.
Yeah, and I think you need more for that, right? So for B2B, you need interoperability. You also need like the user experience to be really perfect. I think there's great progress being made, but we are not there yet. Fully agree with you, Stefan. Also, when it comes to integrating into ERP cash management systems, I mean, Stripe, massive move. Also, SAP having its currency hub supporting USDC, right? So I think there are a lot of movements in the right direction, but I think to really have this 10x, 100x in volume, whatever, it needs more. But I think we are really now on a good path because it's, as always, for payments around network sizes. And if we have this network size now with Visa, PayPal, MasterCard, Stripe, I think that's a very important prerequisite.
Yeah, one last thought maybe on this. And I listened to a podcast with the Bridge founder. He also mentioned batch transactions, right? So usually corporates don't instruct individual transactions, at least if they reach a certain size, which is currently not possible with stablecoins. Maybe account abstraction will help on an infrastructure perspective, that you can sign a long batch of transactions in one go. But that's also something, you know, that is relevant to have in mind. Which use cases would corporates actually use stablecoins for? Which payment use cases? And so still lots of hype, I would say, but we're getting there, that, you know, the respective players are actually eyeing into it and developing solutions. And I think also this will be solved.
Cool. And what we have also seen, and I mean, maybe something to also conclude to the next topic, Stefan, is that there are also new payment protocols being established, right? We talked about Circle in the past. Now it's basically Coinbase, or protocols where you can also use stablecoins to pay. Maybe you can give us a quick update on what this announcement was.
Yeah, Jonas, I think you talk about X402, and I think it didn't get too much attention yet, which will change for sure. And I'm really excited about this one because it's not an invention in one company behind the scenes, but it's trying to leverage HTTP status code from the 90s that wasn't used. So there is this status code 402, payment required. So the idea of this status code is that if you want to access a resource of any kind, maybe an article in the web that you actually need to pay for, then the original idea was in that HTTP status code that you say, okay, we bounce back the request and you find another way to actually pay your access for that. And at the time, we obviously, the HTTP gurus didn't have a good idea how to process that payment. And now Coinbase comes back some 25 years later, actually, and uses that thing via stablecoins. And let me just guide you through what happens. So bear with me when it gets a little bit technical, but I think it's important to understand. So a client requests access to a resource that's X402 enabled. And before that, they're sitting an HTTP server that usually serves that article, for example. And then the server first responds with a 402 response. Yeah, you might know other 40-something return codes from your HTTP server where you're not allowed to access something because you're missing rights. So he just says, okay, you're missing the money, actually, to access that resource. And then the client responds with a new HTTP header. So you need to imagine HTTP requests have these two parts, the header and the body where the actual payload is in. And in this header, you now can formulate an X payment header. That's a new thing where you encode a payment payload. So you say, okay, how much do you want? Are you willing to pay with which token actually? Then your payment gets settled, or the content gets prepared, the payments get settled by a facilitator, and you get back. And what's that good for? Well, that's good for microtransactions. You could imagine that you want to sell an article for 0.09 cent or something like that. So very, very small payment amounts. And together with this account abstraction that we discussed earlier, you could imagine that you have a certain balance in your wallet, about $1 a day for these micro payment content consumption that you want to make possible. And here we are. So this is pay-per-use. Actually, at Tuco, we had 5 or 10 roundtables in 2018, 2019, where all the industry players came to us because we did a lot of IoT projects back then. And we were always discussing pay-per-use, that this was the missing link without having too many subscription models, etc. Yeah? And that's the idea, killing the subscription model, because you don't need to know each other. You just go on a random website that responds with that HTTP status code, and here you go. You pay with USDC 0.1 cent or something like that without a contract, and that might be the interesting part. So what's the regulatory side? Are you allowed to serve this someone via HTTP? So I think there are still some questions open. But I think that's a massive move to rewire the HTTP payment via stablecoins in the back. And it could be something else. Yeah? Don't get me wrong. If you are smart, you could bring other payment rails in there, but stablecoins are an obvious choice for that thing. And just to close it up, so it's not only Coinbase, it's Coinbase together with other prominent players like AWS, Anthropic, Chainlink is in there, Circle is in there, and the obvious use case is to find rails for AI agents. So that's the cool take, that you don't only need to serve humans, but you can now enable micropayments for agentic AI with that thing. So I think that's maybe the bigger news.
And Stefan, if I may ask one question. So is it just that this protocol basically provides a proof of the payment encrypted?
No,
it's more than that.
Yeah, and that's a business case for Coinbase. So they bring a Coinbase X402 facilitator to the picture. So they have a service to settle the payment. Yeah, yeah. You just sign. It's again the same thing like in crypto. So you sign a message that you are willing to pay X amount of money if you are allowed to access the content, for example, and that's a signature. And with that, a payment processor can actually get that money out of your wallet towards the content creator, the provider.
Super interesting. Yeah, and I can imagine, if you then allow a certain balance to be spent by your AI agent on that day, that can potentially even have its own wallet or a smart contract that it has access to, so you can pre-fund, and then once the money is out,
absolutely,
it cannot consume anymore. Yeah.
That's the game we're talking about. Yeah,
very interesting.
Really cool stuff. Really cool stuff. Yeah, I mean, because of course we need standardization and around that for sure. And I think this AI and stablecoin game, I think here we are really just at the beginning, to be honest.
Yeah, we are. I think this is very, very interesting. That's why I'm really excited about.
Yeah, and I mean, stablecoins are all over the place. I mean, this is a new type of money, right? I think this was also the takeaway from the discussion we had with Tony McLaughlin. It's a new type of money. It's not necessarily deposits. Well, eventually, also deposits can be moved via some form of stablecoin. But at the moment, it's really a pre-funded new type of money, electronic money in Europe, that could challenge the way how banking also works. So also banks obviously have not been inactive, especially the US banks over the last weeks. And I think this is the next chapter that we want to dive into a bit. I'm going to cut it short, looking at the time already. But what we've seen over the last weeks is that the US regulators have basically lifted all the previous restrictions on banks in the crypto sector, which means banks can now much more easily provide crypto services like custody, issuance of tokenized assets, like securities, but clearly also money, also providing reserves to stablecoins and so forth, which means that banks are now, US banks predominantly, are now really embracing this new technology here. We've seen a couple of news. So Morgan Stanley, for example, they want to allow crypto investments via their E-Trade brokerage platform. And Bloomberg's reports on this, citing some people that are familiar with the project. So far, Morgan Stanley has not officially commented on it. But this basically follows to the Bitcoin ETF recommendations that advisors could already give to their clients, to Morgan Stanley clients. Now, even the Morgan Stanley clients can go to this brokerage platform and buy crypto directly. How they will do it was not disclosed yet, but that's definitely something that we will also keep an eye on. A major bank in the US, Morgan Stanley, to provide direct crypto exposure to its clients. And the same news basically also with JP Morgan. And this is even more interesting because Jamie Dimon, the CEO, has always been extremely skeptical around Bitcoin. He still is. Yeah. So he says basically, well, I don't think you should smoke, but I defend your right to smoke. I defend your right to buy Bitcoin. That's a sentence that he gave on an investor call. So ultimately, he still does not believe that it's a good thing, but you know, demand is rising and now they also want to provide access to crypto. They don't yet have a custody solution, so eventually they will partner with any of the existing custody providers like Coinbase or you know, Anchorage, Paxos, Ripple, whatever. But that's also clearly a quite bold move of these two major US banks into offering crypto to end users. And JP Morgan so far was really centered around their own private blockchain Kinexys, right? And also in this area, we've seen quite some interesting news. So they onboarded now 8, apparently, Middle East banks to its 24/7 available payments platform. And yeah, why is that interesting? Because on Sundays in the Middle East, banks are not closed, but it's a regular working day. And if they want to move US dollars, then clearly they are restricted by that because no US dollar clearing is possible on Sundays. However, with the Kinexys solution of JP Morgan, that is possible. And therefore, we saw quite some interest in this area. 8 additional banks apparently to join Kinexys predominantly for the 24/7 availability. Is blockchain needed for that? I'm not so sure, right? But at least this is what we see in the market being provided by JP Morgan, which is the industry standard and industry leading player, I would say, right? And then there was also interesting news where they integrated with Ondo Finance, which has a public blockchain, to ultimately use JP Morgan deposit accounts on their Kinexys blockchain to settle a money market fund transaction on this public permissionless network. They use Chainlink's cross-chain orchestration infrastructure, the CCIP. And yeah, so far it was only on testnet of Ondo, but it shows clearly that they are also eyeing into using their settlement infrastructure for transactions that are ultimately settling an asset that is issued on a public blockchain, so therefore enabling private and public blockchain interoperability.
What I don't understand here, Manu, is why they chose this blockchain. So on one hand side, I like that even JP Morgan, who are actually at the forefront of private permission chains with all that solution, I think they are really massive going on in that direction. And then they open up, but they that was the first time I heard that Ondo has its own public chain. So I think it's still not the bold move. Someone they know also have a contract. So that I had to smile a bit when I was reading that. And I like the guys at JPM, so I don't want to criticize here because maybe I just don't know enough. But it's not yet the big move from my perspective. Maybe it's a trial.
I'm not an expert in what Ondo does either, but what I saw is that they are really working together with major asset managers and tokenized money market fund providers like BlackRock, Fidelity, Franklin Templeton, Wellington, WisdomTree, and so forth. So it might be that, you know, this blockchain really embraces RWAs, real world assets for the traditional financial sector, and apparently also has some you know, privacy features. And maybe that's why they chose it. But I agree. I mean, if you were to include onto Ethereum, Layer 2, or even Solana, there's much more traffic likely.
Absolutely.
And I think what this news also show is that you, as a bank, you're often not the first, you know, the first one to the party of crypto. So, I mean, we see this over the past few years that there is a hesitance against crypto, stablecoins and co. But today's episode for me made it also clear once again, basically, that it's inevitable. So I think there is really no way that in a few years from now, let's say 3 years, maybe 5 years, that all the major banks provide crypto services. And I mean the US, I also mean Germany. So yeah, I think really, you know, you can be late to the parties, banks often are. But to be honest, there is so much momentum, demand there, and also money to make ultimately, that this for me also shows again that, that's the future, how it looked like. And maybe it's a bold statement, but I think, let's maybe really say 3 years, we see this everywhere. So let's talk in 3 years.
Let's see, yeah. I mean, there were two additional also quite interesting news on stablecoin joint ventures. What is known, I think, is that Korean banks also got together and want to form a joint venture to issue a joint Korean, South Korean stablecoin. Major banks are involved, KB Kukmin, Shinam, Wuri. These are basically the biggest banks in South Korea. And also KFTC, which is the operator of the main retail payment system. And that also is a good bridge to what is happening in the US, because also there, payment system providers, or ultimately the joint ventures and the companies behind those, which is the clearinghouse, TCH, and also Early Warning Services, which is the operator of the peer-to-peer payment system Zelle in the US, they have brought banks together, major banks. So we're talking, you know, JP Morgan, Citi, BNY Mellon, and so forth, and discussed whether and how a joint stablecoin could be issued. Only the Wall Street Journal so far reported, but there seems to be something behind it, that also these banks are now at least investigating different use cases. I mean, given that this has been driven by the payment services or by the payment systems ultimately, maybe they are eyeing into a wholesale use case. Nobody knows, right? Stablecoins can be used for different use cases, as we discussed. But that's clearly also interesting developments, that banks now also get together and discuss whether or not to issue a joint venture create a joint venture to issue a joint stablecoin.
And let me be a little bit provocative. Hopefully more comes out than for typical consortia that come together in the banking context.
So yeah, lots of news also, especially on US banks, either providing crypto services and crypto access, but also continuing their journey on settlement of money on blockchains. But also the tokenized asset space has been quite interesting, also here in Europe. So 21X announced its first live operation, which ultimately is a new US dollar yield token, the US money market fund from Manta, that will be listed and is available now for issuance and redemption via 21X, so primary market first. And then, the secondary market transaction so far is not possible, but they're working on that. And so what is 21X? It's a TSS, so a trading and settlement system venue that is one of the first that got the license of the DLT pilot regime. So ultimately to operate a secondary marketplace where settlement of assets and money can take place. And they want to settle using stablecoins, and also have engaged now in another partnership with Quantos, which is a Dutch company. And apart from that, they announced other corporations as well with Apex to ultimately bring assets from Asia into or onto the platform. They also did a partnership with SBI Digital Markets to tokenize those Asian securities on 21X's DLT exchange. And then also with Dusk, which is a different and new blockchain that I honestly also didn't know, but which is also very privacy focused and focused on real world asset adoption. And Dusk also is a partner with Quantos, who provides stablecoins. So it all comes, full circle here. So definitely interested to follow what will happen on this area, because 21X is really, I think, worldwide the first platform to provide a regulatory compliant secondary market for tokenized securities. So far, not too much has happened in that regard, but it's quite interesting how that space will develop also under this DLT pilot regime in Europe.
And Manuel, is this for companies or for retail end users? So who can ultimately trade these tokenized assets on 21X?
Yeah, so far, it's only institutional investors, so those that are eligible to trade those assets. But I think in the long run, they also want to open up for retail users, because this is allowed on this DLT pilot regime. to allow end users as well, which is groundbreaking because so far this was never possible on a CSD, on an MTF. You as a retail user could never trade.
And they are very focused also on corporates. We rarely, I think that's the big gap in this whole discussion again and again and again, that we talk about institutional investors or banks or retail, but not about corporates who might want to do treasury management via that platform. That's also the important point for the privacy things, I think, because if you're a corporate, you don't want everybody to see the movement of your treasury items. So that's, I think, a very important point to consider.
Yeah, and two other interesting developments that go into the same direction. So existing players, Robinhood, the retail broker in the US, but then also Kraken, which is the or one of the biggest crypto exchanges, they both want to bring tokenized stocks into reality and allow for 24/7 trading of not only stocks, but let's say regulated securities, also including ETFs. And both really want to focus on this now and provide these services first to Europe, for example, to allow US stocks and US securities to settle on a 24/7 basis. So similar path by Robinhood and Kraken. Robinhood is also engaged in an M&A and or wants to buy the Canadian crypto firm WonderFi for $250 million in an all-cash deal. And so they are not a crypto player, but, right? But they want to get this crypto exchange and also have bought Bitstamp last year. So they're really grasping for the crypto infrastructure and the crypto players. So first of all, obviously, to get a bigger foothold in cryptocurrencies. But then second of all, clearly also to use the new tech rails to provide 24/7 infrastructure for trading of tokenized securities then.
Manu, I would object here. I think I saw statistics that the majority of Robinhood's revenue is driven by crypto by now. So I would consider them a crypto player. They moved early on. So even if the history is a different one, but I think all these players like also Revolut and others, they have a clear idea, a very clear idea where the money is being made. Yeah.
Yeah. No, fair point. That's definitely true. And Robinhood, nevertheless, also has a big interest to provide this new infrastructure for, you know, regulated U.S. securities, and also submitted a letter to the SEC to create a new federal framework for tokenized real-world assets, aiming to modernize the whole U.S. securities market. And it basically calls for a unified national framework to replace the fragmented state-by-state compliance approach that currently governs securities in the U.S., and also that, you know, the tokens represent those assets should be legally equivalent to the underlying asset, which is also not the case yet, right? Let's see what comes out of that. But it's a bold move of Robinhood to really now ask for a complete new overhaul of regulation, but then also the framework around trading and settlement, which would imply a complete new infrastructure based on blockchain.
And I guess these neobanks and neobrokers, they are the perfect fit for this revolution and also merging the new world with the old world. You know, they have an ultimate interest in handling different kinds of assets similarly, because it will bring down that technology cost, that development cost. So if you can tokenize something and can treat it similarly to other tokenized assets, they will profit from that. They are ultimately very strong with tech. So I think they are the favorite players to show us where this all might lead. And you see the both crypto native players like Kraken going to the old world and incorporating TradFi aspects in their business and the other way around. So yeah, that's a fight for market share, obviously. And yeah, let's see where this will lead us.
Yeah.
And curious to see when this will arrive in for German neobanks as well, right? Because Trade Republic, we know they also secured now a crypto license. I think it was a Mika license or some kind of license. Also entering more and more the space, even if currently the work is still done with a partner. But yeah, I think that's super interesting, because if you bring these topics together of assets on a blockchain, settlement on a blockchain, and crypto. So these three things where we've seen just today discussed tremendous progress, then really, you know, that's the prerequisite for really the financial market of the future, if you will. So Also here, very bold moves, Manuel. And I think 21X, the secondary market is also super interesting because we talked for years that it needs a secondary market. And everybody was saying, yeah, but we don't have a secondary market. So this argument now is about to change, which I think can bring also more momentum on the RWA side.
Yeah, and I mean, looking at the time, let's maybe wrap up this last section as well with just three other headlines, which was also very interesting. So BlackRock and BNY now team up to tokenize shares of an existing $150 billion treasury trust fund, which is also a money market fund. $150 billion, well, BlackRock already has one, which is the Biddle Fund, but that's only $1.7 billion. So it's an order of magnitude larger, what they now want to do with BNY Mellon. And also, they will be issued rather on BNY Mellon chain, so a private chain as it looks, and not on a public chain. So really differentiating the use cases, right? Where some institutional investors might not want the full transparency of public chains, they could then also buy into tokenized money market funds issued by BlackRock and BNY on a private chain. So that was quite an interesting announcement. Then also Citi and SDX, they want to collaborate on tokenizing late-stage private equity on SDX, which is the digital CSD in Switzerland. And Citi wants to become a custodian and also tokenizer for these securities on SDX.
Manu, the fun thing is that this happened during my moderation at Point Zero Forum. So so actually, they got my complete preparation for that panel out of order because they said me one day before that there will be an exclusive Bloomberg announcement and nobody should know beforehand. So I had a strict NDA to not say anything. I completely revamped my preparation for the panel and included that announcement. So that was quite some fun for me, I can tell you.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, and this is a completely new equity asset class, right? So late-stage private equity. I think lots of aspirations are also in the equity space and talking about alternatives. Now we see it, right? Let's see whether they succeed, obviously, but there's definitely now bold moves to move into this area to democratize access to this late-stage private equity class.
Yeah, it's getting rid of paper again. So it's a classical digitalization case because you need to do these paperworks for every asset, not once as an investor, for example, but for every asset you buy, you need to go through the same paper-heavy process that they want to get rid of.
Yeah, and then the very last news was that Coinbase acquired a crypto derivatives exchange, Deribit, for $2.9 billion. This is the largest crypto merger or acquisition ever happened, $2.9 billion. Why is that? Well, Deribit is a major player in crypto options, which is so far not a regulated market in the US. There's basically uncertainty whether the SEC or the CFTC should take over the regulation and the oversight here. But it appears that this is a hedge or a bet into the future because also Kraken, they bought a couple of weeks back NinjaTrader for $1.5 billion, which is also a crypto derivatives trading venue. And it appears to me that they're anticipating also regulation in the US because both platforms, Deribit and NinjaTrader, do not offer their services at the moment to US clients. But now those major players in the crypto space now basically bought those derivatives exchanges, likely in anticipation of more regulatory framework and clearance as well.
A lot of M&A activity. So let's see if now Ripple will also buy Circle. <or not. laughs> Cool. So to kind of conclude, maybe let's come last but not least to our knowledge bites. So our very tiny bites for our listeners on various topics that we read and thought interesting to share. Maybe Stefan, you wanna start. What did you bring to us?
Yeah, I brought it last minute because you informed me on short notice. But I thought about the cool thing is Satya Nadella. So he did that now several times. I think he did it first in December when he said SaaS is dead. So parts of Microsoft Business is declared dead by Microsoft themselves. So what they say is that the agentic web is reshaping the entire tech stack, so that most websites, most mobile apps might lose the importance or might go completely away because people will talk to their computers, to their mobile phones, and actually don't use apps because everything will be provided in the right format just in time. And if you need an app, you might create it on the fly if agentic AI gets that far away. But yeah, I think this is a massive thing for everybody who is in software, and I'm in software, so it's very, very much a discussion for us at Zuke. So where will we need more people? Where will we need different education for our own employees in the future? How will apps be built? I think this, how will this the typical stack look like? So we are used to these apps with databases in the back for many decades. And now this seems to change somehow, and agents walk in between. So a new intermediary, if you want. So the ones who control the agentic stack, they might have quite some power going forward. And Microsoft obviously tries to become that layer. Others will too. So yeah, that's my finding of the week. And there's a great video with Satya. We might link in the show notes.
Cool. Yeah, thanks for sharing. We'll definitely check it out.
I brought an article from Bloomberg. The Trump family is going all in on crypto projects, from Bitcoin mining to stablecoins. And it's basically an overview of what the Trump family now does in crypto. And it's already from April 12th, so a bit older. However, I still find it relevant. And I think it should be extended, because over the last weeks, also new additional news came out what the Trump family does. So it started all with non-fungible tokens, then decentralized finance in September 24 already. Then clearly the meme coin craziness with the Trump coin, ETFs, then the stable coin with World Liberty Financial stable coin, and now also Bitcoin mining. So yeah, there's definitely room for lots of conflict of interest. And that article tries to summarize what the Trump family currently does with crypto.
Nice. Definitely a worthwhile overview. I went a little bit in a different direction today with my knowledge bite. And it's actually a blog post from Google. Because very interestingly, Google is integrating zero knowledge proofs in their wallets, which for me personally is just very, very interesting. I remember when I started going into this topic 5 or 6 years ago, it was really a niche. People didn't take this innovation seriously, as so often with new innovation. But now Google is putting this into the wallets, and basically apps like partner apps like Bumble, for example, will use zero knowledge proof. So the dating app, so that you, for example, can prove you're older than 18 without really showing your ID in the sense, right? And I think that's massive around this zero knowledge side of things. If a key player like Google is now embracing this, is including this in the wallet functionalities. And I think that's just the first of a lot of other news that will come out of this in the next few months, maybe years, who knows. All right, so let's wrap it up. So Manoj, Stefan, it was a really great pleasure to do this episode with you. Really a lot happened in May. I'm sure a lot will happen also for the next news episode. So thanks for being with us. Thanks for your preparations. It was super interesting.
Thank you, Jonas.
And then of course also the audience, it was great. Thanks for joining this episode. Of course, if you like this podcast, as always, please subscribe to our Telegram group, or to join our community, like our podcast, refer you to your friends. So a lot of options how you can help us, that we get just more reach and can educate more people when it comes to how the future of money will look like. So in this lane, thanks you so much, everybody.
Thank you.
See you next time.
Bye-bye.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.